bitch, I'm not in debate class. I'll slap you across the fucking face, you lie to me.
I apologize for being a white male. I'll do my best not to be next time. Usually from week to week, I have had the pleasure of interviewing outsiders, both figuratively and literally, in various fields from filmmaking to literature and even comic books. Instead of the conventional interview, we're going to do something a little different today, and I found the perfect candidate to just celebrate the merits of literature for its own sake, because we don't get enough of that. In this hyper-fast food type culture, there are far too many people who just want to devour a book, review it, and move on, and tag it on Facebook because it's written by their best friend at the moment. Best friend of the week, I should say. And I have always despised this sentiment that, you know, of throwing the new book out with the bathwater after it's a week old. Everything is moving fast, even publishing. And the gentleman that I've brought on today, he's been on, he came on my older show to document and report on the Wonderland Awards ceremony for the 2013 BizarroCon. And did some stellar coverage of that event, told me everything I needed to know. And I'm talking about Chris Secknewsom, adventurer and writer extraordinaire. Chris, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you very much for having me back. I did take you actually into kind of the hot tub at BizarroCon back in 2016. Gee, it was very cold weather. I think I was a little bit. The adventurer thing helps out when you sort of are doing gigs like that. It was abominable weather, let's just say, you know.
Yes.
But I'm very pleased to be with you today and talking about, you know, some books that maybe still matter. I from my point of view, I think I would kick off with a little bit of a mention of the death of Bill Gass the other day, William Gass.
Okay, yeah, he wrote The Tunnel, right?
He did,
okay.
And in many books that were published by David Godin, who, I don't know if people, David Godin his publishing company is based in Boston. He was a Dartmouth graduate who inherited a lot of money and decided he loved books. He was not a writer himself. He's someone who, kind of like James Laughlin of New Directions, although Laughlin did, you know, write some poetry. He knew that he was interested in literature and interested in beautiful book products. And he published Gas in the early days. I mean, those are the books, you know, book lovers talk about smelling books, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just the feel, it's just the smell. I mean, everything about those books is just from the typeface to the binding. Everything is just in keeping with the quality of the prose, without being precious at all, I might say. But they are fine art products, for sure. So, but Gass, he wrote The Tunnel. He was stuck in the tunnel, as Stanley Elkin said, for years. One of the great cases of writer's block. But he did finish it, and I think it's one of, you know, the great achievements. And I'm sorry that he passed. He was 93, and I don't think he's gotten the attention that he deserved. But he would be a good person for people to come back to, you know, who are interested in really quality prose. He would be someone great to come back to in the new year, you know?
Mm-hmm. I wonder what sort of posthumous works he left behind.
I was trying to find that out. I was a long-time friend with his colleague Stanley Elkin at Washington in St. Louis. And Stanley died a long time ago, of course. He had MS, and it was a great American comedic writer. He always said that Bill had a lot pipeline, so maybe we'll hear more, I hope, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a cool thing if that were true. I don't know who agents Bill, but it would be nice to think there was more stuff coming, you know. That would be great.
Yeah. I just finished this book today called F-250 by Bud Smith, and I mean, it was really picturesque as far as illustrating this really loose lifestyle of this 20-something guy who lives, you know, these type of books, these sprawling works where of these troubled youths where they live in these houses almost communally with all these other outcasts and losers who do drugs and they collect records and they get into all these various wacky sex adventures, sexcapades. You know that type of book, right? We've seen it over and over.
Oh, I did. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was like that, and he gets into this threesome with a Norwegian, like, I guess they would call her a manic pixie girl, who's, like, free of any sentimental, like, any sentimental love-making or anything. She just wants to get laid. And she's also dating this lesbian, and they want to have sex with this guy as sort of a novelty act or something. And one of his friends ODs as the week that the house is due to be demolished due to them being 4 months behind on rent. And it was a very pastorally written book. And I just finished that today. And I just wanted to celebrate, you know, while we're just, you know, showing our appreciation for the written word. I just wanted to throw that name out there. F-250 by Bud Smith. Now, you may be the only other person that I know who has actually read A Fan's Notes by, was it William Exley?
Frederick
Exley, yeah. And how do you describe this? It was a trilogy, but most people kind of tuned out after the first volume, and I can understand why, because something is lost in this in each subsequent volume. But this guy spends some time trying to find himself through, like, mimicking the writing style of Hemingway. He thinks that he's a writer, and he comes to the conclusion early on that he's not a writer, he's just a fan, and that's all he'll ever be. And he alludes to his literary heroes, such as Hemingway and the guy who wrote To the Finland Station. What was that guy's name?
I'm not sure. He certainly was influenced by Reg Lager a lot. Mm-hmm. You know?
But and then he spends some time in a madhouse where he undergoes what do they call it? A electro.
I think he went through electroshock therapy.
Yeah.
You know? It was pretty horrific. Yeah. I mean, there's no question. And to put that thing in context, you know, he wrote A Fan's Note and started his publishing career in the 1960s, right alongside Thomas Pynchon and Robert Coover, who Coover remains one of my favorite writers still. And it was a very marginal sort of time when people who, you know, really did have, you know, some mental health issues were still on the books, you know. They weren't written off as they are, you know, perhaps today. Actually, I think from memory, just go back to Finland. Isn't that Edmund Wilson who wrote that, I think?
Yes. That was the author of To the Finland Station. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that is right. So, I mean, Exley was, I don't think that he's not writing like an MFA sort of book, you know, trying to be like a big-time writer. He was writing something from the depths of mind and soul that very few people are working from today, sadly, you know.
So you think it was autobiographical, much of the content, then?
Oh, absolutely. I think that he's certainly embedded in, if not encoded in the prose style, which is, it still works incredibly well today. I think it's not the kind of thing that a lot of people are able to read today, because they just don't have the gumption. He mixed a lyricism with a strength of voice that is unusual in American writing. And I think someone like, Selby, Requiem for a Dream, and, Last Exit to Brooklyn, that kind of sort of person. He was, not only, on the drug addict side, but he was certainly writing from a point of tremendous personal compromise mentally, and he takes you on a journey that is just, I still admire it. I just openly admire it.
We've got to talk about this one scene, and you know the scene because we've laughed about it several times off the air. It's the scene nearing the final quarter length of the book, wherein he meets this guy who goes into schoolboy hysterics anytime there's any talk of cunnilingus. It's like the guy reverts to a schoolboy or something, and they take this salesman job together, right? And the guy's name is Mr. Blue. Now, do you want to set it up, or should I?
You set it up because you got that wonderful Southern accent, and I'll follow in. I'll harmonize.
Okay, so they go on the road together. This Mr. Blue and the main character of A Fan's Notes, and they arrange to drop by this man's house. I think he was a business associate from another venture or something. And from what they understand, they're given to understand that the wife is, mostly deaf in one ear. Is it both? Is it both ears or just one? I think it's both. She's deaf?
It's both, and it's enough to be very, very funny in that old, thoughtful way. You're setting this up very well, Jeremy, very well.
Now, at some point, he and Mr. Blue have had a drink together at a bar, and they're talking about, the things that women, the things that excite women, and how they're so flowery and elegant. And one of the bar patrons says, "Elegant? If you've ever looked in the toilet bowl of a women's restroom, you're sadly mistaken to say they're elegant." But
it's wonderful. Oh, yeah. And that is just the hint of a thread that runs through this whole section of the book. He's really knocking the stuffing out of every stereotypical expectation about, standards of American behavior,
It skewers every modern, like contemporary attitude of the time. Anything that seems deserving of nobility gets skewered in Exley's trilogy, but particularly in A Fan's Notes, and because some of his romantic assumptions were wrecked at the time as he was in the process of growing, I'm sure. Like, he thought he was entitled to some living because he had these creative tendencies, which he found out the hard way was not the case. But before I digress, so they go to sell something. I think it's like wallpaper or something, samples of wallpaper or some designs for home interior decorating to this wife. And Mr. Blue is on one of his schoolboy hysterical sessions, and he keeps shouting these things at the top of his lungs, knowing that she can't hear, this wife can't hear what he's saying. Maybe
he's got alligator shoes on, don't forget.
Yes. The husband, I think maybe the husband ducks out of the room or is late getting home or something. That's what I'm fuzzy on. Like, how they're... I think she must be only deaf in one ear for this scene to have been pulled off. It has been so long. But the 1-2 punch of this scene is that as they're trying to sell this to him, the guy keeps shouting off stuff like, how would you like me to lick your cunt? Or, you know, would you like me to tickle your clit, honey? Or something? And these are examples of what he's saying. I'm not recalling it word for word, but, and we're given a description of her as she looks down at the floor and her face keeps getting redder and redder every time this guy is running his flapper at her. And the guy who's telling the story, the narrator, is just trying to make the sale. And Mr. Blue, this jerk off, keeps shouting out these horribly inappropriate sexually suggestive statements, and her face keeps getting redder and redder. And that's when the narrator makes the connection that it's a charade. She's not as deaf as she lets on. And before we know it, he's jerking Mr. Blue out onto the lawn. He's quickly shutting the briefcase, and Mr. Blue's still having a ball with it, shouting at the doorstep that he's being dragged off of, shouting all these horribly inappropriate things, not realizing that the woman's not as deaf as she lets on.
Oh, it's just a wonderful thing. He's a wonderful character.
Yeah, and
you know, I mean, absolutely committed to Cunnilingus. You know, in all the wrong times.
And he finally loads Mr. Blue into the car, and he's driven around the same cul-de-sac twice because he's so humiliated and angry and unsure of what this means for his job security. By the time he reaches the end of the cul-de-sac twice, he shouts out at Mr. Blue in the passenger seat, maybe you should just find a human target, you know, and work out your sexual frustrations. You can doll it up. You can doll up your girl's lady parts with any kind of fragrances, and it'll smell like what was the term he used? You can make it smell like cookie dough or peppermint incense. You know, you can make it smell like whatever. Just try it out on a human target and stop projecting onto people who aren't interested, you dumbass. It was something along those lines that he told him off with. And we find out later, I think he goes to Mr. Blue's home, and Mr. Blue ends up dying by shaving cream. Is that right? Because he smokes
Yes. A jumbo-sized can of mentholated, you know, it sort of stimulates the skin, a little bit of a sting, kind of a nice fragrance later. Yeah. Mentholated shaving cream. Yep.
Was it? He lights a cigarette. He's not supposed to be smoking because his wife won't let him, and he tries to sneak a smoke in the bathroom, and he accidentally sets the shaving cream canister on fire, and it just explodes on him or something, right?
Correct.
Classic.
A bomb. You know, I think that what you're saying there are two things. My take out is two things, and it's still, after all these years, that we get a completely ordinary, down to the ground look at life, and then also this absolutely wonderful, ludicrous look at extreme situations that happen. All in, often in one paragraph. you know? He does that throughout the book. The whole book is like, the whole book is kind of modeled on the idea of the paragraph, which I think is a wonderful model. And there is, in every paragraph, there's something outrageous that happens in the context of something completely ordinary, which when you think about it, you know, I mean, that is the basis of some of the best vaudeville comedy, you know, that's the premise. You know, it starts off simple, you know. It was so easy to go knock on someone's door and try to sell something. What could be easier than that, you know, in those days? Maybe harder now. But it just, and then when things go terribly wrong for this person, I think Mr. Blue is a great character. What it makes me think about it, for people who haven't read the book, I think it would be terrific for them to review Sinclair Lewis, who's kind of back in the news with Couldn't Happen Here. But I would go back to a book like Babbitt or Main Street and look at what America seemed to be, you know, in the 1920s, and then look at Mr. Blue's character. Because in part, what his problem is he's lost in time, which a lot of that can happen to a lot of us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He's just, his timing is terrible. His timing about women, his timing about sales pitches, his, you know, the demeaning doorknob knock is, I think, an excellent term. You're always in the wrong place when you're knocking on doors selling things. I used to sell Encyclopedia Britannicas at one point in an all-black neighborhood, and that was one of the best experiences. I mean, it was bizarre, and it made me think about things like timing, you know? And actually gets that wonderful sense of humor, and it just, you know, it really is a treat to read that, because it's kind of, I don't know, I mean, when I think about that book, and he did publish other stuff, but that book in particular seems to be something that was completely not manufactured by the New York publishing industry, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I just don't get that feeling at all, do you?
I feel like it, I'm surprised it's not more well known among various sets of counterculture, because, I mean, Tropic of Cancer enjoyed a resurgence of appreciation in the, 80s or 90s, right? And it was criticized as being taboo in the time it was published originally. So I'm surprised that A Fan's Notes isn't more well known. I'm disappointed that it's not. It's serialized, and it goes from character to character as he tries to figure out his place in the Americana, you know, of life. He's searching for himself in all these other characters with their own eccentricities, who don't go, they don't question their place in the world. They just are, and they're comfortable with it. And I think the character is supposed to represent those of us who are thinking to themselves, I see these wacky characters outside of me. Why can't I accept who I am the way they do?
Well, you know, you mentioned talking about cancer and you know, all of Miller's work. Here's a thought on that. When I first arrived in Las Vegas, I have the Gallagher Fellow at Black Mountain Institute, and I got invited to do an ACLU event about banned books at the main Clark County Library System.
Mm-hmm.
There are 10, you know, local people in letters, including one Pulitzer Prize journalist, and everyone got to nominate, you know, a book that had been banned at some point, and then to read an excerpt from it. And I chose Tropic of Cancer. And I read a section that, I mean, I think it's just wonderful writing. But I was the only person that, out of 10, and we're talking, you know, one of them was a Pulitzer Prize journalist who chose his thing. And there was a woman who chose, you know, some, you know, children's book and, you know, on and on and on. I was the only one that people really got stirred by. A woman who had brought, an 8-year-old child left because of it. I wouldn't have brought an 8-year-old child to a banned books, you know.
Yeah.
What do you expect, right?
Bad move.
And I got reviews in the newspaper, and, you know, it was the only thing that, and I thought, you know, honestly, we're talking about a four-letter word here that got people upset, you know. Mm. Talk about George Carlin and the seven words, you know.
Mm.
And it was about banned books. I thought I was kind of on good ground with friends, right, you know.
Yeah.
And it was hilarious. I mean, I kept a good sense of humor about it, but I realized that people can still, in America, can still be offended about the least little thing. And, I mean, you know, what other word are you going to use that's going to be better for that particular body part, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was nonsensical. But I think that is some of what's happened with not just Axie, but with many of these interesting figures. And I think, sadly, you know, I think there it's a lot of the best male writers and some of the most interesting female writers who have been kind of outlawed by not an obvious censorship, but more of an indirect censorship, if you know what I mean, you know? And that offends me, you know? In this offense culture, everyone could be offended. Well, I get offended by that. I think, you know, these are good books.
Here's how things have changed. You made an example that a parent who brought their 8-year-old to a banned books reading event left with their kid in a huff. Well, now it's not even about protecting the virgin ears of the children. It's about protecting the virgin ears of these pampered little tepid snowflakes, you know, that don't think that they can stand up to the unbridled fury of words.
It's terrible. It really is terrible. I mean, I think, here's my view on that, because I've been teaching the last 5 years. I think that it gets worse and worse the higher up the socioeconomic food chain you go to private, smaller colleges. In other words, you move from universities right on up. I've taught at some, what I would call, pretty good working class level student, you know, groups.
Mm-hmm.
And they're much more reasonable, you know. But even so, this is a problem. You still have to, I mean, nobody asked me when they would, you know, start reading Ishmael Reed or, you know, they didn't say, you know, this is a warning here, you know. We just dove into it because we wanted to explore words and ideas. That's why we were there, you know, in university. So, no, I'm with you on this. I think we've got the wrong idea in America, and if this just gets worse, what it's going to do is just completely eliminate the humanities. Not just English, all of it, you know?
The humanities thing. Being what? Like English, social studies, what else? Philosophy?
Oh, anthropology, all the arts, history. I think history is in terrible shape now. We now want people to revise history and to cherry pick it and to, you know, they want to talk about one subject and then dismiss a whole bunch of other people when all those innovations, all those connections are desperately intertwined.
Here's a problem, Chris, that I ran into a while back. I went on a show and somehow the Nazis got brought up. And I wasn't talking about them to glorify them, but I wanted to talk about some things because they were mentioned early on in the show before I came into the chat. And because I tried to breach that topic, one of the hosts actually left his own show out of protest. Why? Because he was Jewish. Now, it's part of history, that's all. But this guy would not hear of it, you know? And I've devoted a lot of time to researching that period in history because my grandmother escaped from Germany. and he would not even hear of it. On his own show, he left out of protest and left his other co-hosts in a slump because he wasn't strong enough to stand up with his convictions to hearing anything that might run counter to his narrative.
Well, you know, narrative is this is my big, I've sort of shifted focus in teaching to media studies and the history of mass communications. So I've been called in talking about narratives. I just did a lecture all day at UNLV the other day. You know, these are off-the-shelf default study ideas. That's what a narrative means, really. It's not a nuanced argument. It's not an evolving argument. It's absolutely a calcified argument that is put forward when you don't have new information that you have to, you know, to deal with in the news. That's in the media terms what a narrative is now. And I think a lot of people are, they've shifted gears to only hearing the calcified arguments. They're not able to evolve and conversationalize and improvise in that musical sense around new information or information that's just being presented in the moment. They just shut down. And we're taught that in America. I mean, I think that's kind of the norm. I know a lot of very, very interesting people who are moderates to leftists in Israel who are appalled by that kind of thinking. You know, they're very intellectual, interesting people, and they're appalled by the fact that the narrative, so to speak, in terms of the Middle East and has been co-opted by, you know, a right-wing force. And that's hard to come back from. It's hard for them to get a voice in. So wherever we find those voices, we need to celebrate them. But I think people are just overreacting to, you know, any argument that comes their way. It's just the norm now, you know, and it's really sad. It could be a race argument, a gender argument, a nationality or ethnic argument. It doesn't matter. It's just the natural reaction is to, nope, I'm out of here, or you're wrong.
Yeah.
One way or the other.
Yeah, like, you know, people are so hung up on the term Nazi that I don't know that we'll ever see. There's something about the time period in the early 20s that is fascinating and that I never see talked about, and that there was an astrological civil war in Germany at one point when they had the Central Astrological Office, and then they had the Astrological Society in Germany, and they both came to differing conclusions on the same topic. And then you had the Hamburg School where they would graduate from in order to end up in either the Astrological Society or the Central Astrological Office. We will never see any kind of book, fiction or nonfiction, I don't think, about this astrological civil war in war-torn Germany, because we're not even allowed to talk about Nazis anymore in a historical context.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things we're not able to talk about, and I'm hoping that that's just a little historical glitch. For me, there are a lot of things that were happening in pre-Civil War America that I find very interesting that I would like to talk about. I've got a whole work that I think I might have to put on hold just because it raises a bunch of, you know, questions that people aren't willing to deal with. I mean, one of them is very frankly, the idea, if people know anything about St. Louis, they know it is a world crossroads. It's the dividing point between west and east and north and south. It's why we've had a lot of turmoil there recently. In the 1850s, it was a fabulously interesting city where it had the highest number of free black people of any city in America, and it also had more slave auction houses than Memphis, New Orleans, or all those things that we've heard about in history books and movies, you know? And It was a complete hotbed of conflict, contradiction, and nuanced thinking. That there was no easy answer. And there were many black people in that day who actually went back, even if they had never been in it, they went into the slavery system to protect themselves. They wanted the health care benefits. They wanted to not be stalked and hassled, you know, by white predators. They wanted the protection of the plantation system. Now, that's something I don't think a lot of people know about. And I certainly didn't until I started researching it. The idea of going back or entering willfully into slavery seems, you know, contrary to any sort of idea.
Well, I wonder if that's talk about that now. Well, I wonder if that's Stockholm Syndrome a little bit, maybe.
Perhaps, but I think it was very, very pragmatic. I think that the ultimate thing was, you know, this shadow is hanging over your head all the time. Maybe make a choice and try to negotiate the best future for you and your family to stay together as a family, you know. And no one is saying with this, obviously, that the slavery system isn't anything other than horrific and a nightmare for America to deal with today. But I guess the point is, or my point anyway, is that people had to make actual choices about dealing with that system in the moment. And we no longer can talk about anything because ideologically the whole subject is packaged for us in historical, academic, and media terms. And I think that's unfortunate. I really do. I think that's not being able to unpack a critical aspect of American culture and really talk about it, you know? Mm.
You know, you spoke about banned books earlier. I find it a great source of frustration that someone endeavored to write a sequel of sorts to Catcher in the Rye, an unofficial sequel, and the guy went under... it was called 60 Years Later, Coming Through the Rye. Have you heard of this?
I heard about it, and I'm not a fan of Salinger. I actually ran into the true story, Jeremy. I know you won't believe it, but it's a true story. He lives in Cornish, New Hampshire, right?
Yes.
And I went to school around the corner, and I did some, you know, occasionally did some hallucinogenic types of, you know, things you put on your tongue and strange things happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
I ran into him at his local mailbox. I was given a package by a kind of girlfriend then, and I hadn't mailed it. And I had it in the car. I shouldn't have been driving at all. But I decided I was going to stop at the Cornish, New Hampshire mailbox, post office, and mail this damn package because, you know, it was important to my trip, right?
Mm-hmm.
Literally. And who did I physically run into but Mr. Salinger? I never was a big fan of Catcher in the Rye after age 14. You know, I think that's kind of that's the age when we discover it. So I haven't read that, but I have heard about the book. But I should confess that I have, under my own name and other ghost names, contributed to ongoing installments in the Sherlock Holmes mythology. So I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with keeping the mythology alive. I just don't think Catcher was ever worth that. That's my view.
You know, I think a lot of people move on from the petulant Holden Caulfield, who means well, but is just too surly for his age. Everybody reads Catcher in the Rye, and they can relate to it on some level, but then they move away from it and say, I never got what the big deal was about it. But, and yet, I can distinctly remember friends loving it when they first read it, and then they get away from it later. I think a lot of people do that, and maybe in some metaphysical, you know, way, Holden was, you know, keeping us all from going over the side of the cliff. And then it was no longer necessary to be a fan after that, right?
Well, you know, I think that's a really important point from the teaching educational side of things. There are certain moments for certain books, you know, and I think that we can put Catcher in that category. I like the book A Separate Piece, although that's set at a boys' school in the Northeast, and it's male-oriented. I still think that speaks to a lot of people at a certain age in life. I was a big fan of Lord of the Flies, and I'm interested in the new movie. I was going to ask you about this, what you think of the new movie, Lord of the Flies, with an all-girl cast. To me, that's an interesting idea. I was a huge fan. I don't know if you ever have you ever read A High Wind in Jamaica?
No, I've read Lord of the Flies, but I have not read A High Wind in Jamaica.
I really recommend that to you and your listeners. I think that's a wonderful book. It has something of the same theme to it. I don't want to go into it too much, but it's about some English kids who are kidnapped in Jamaica by pirates and show themselves to be pirates, in a sense. And what's interesting is that the main figure is a girl, and I don't know. In a weird way, I'd want to play her in a movie. I don't think that it was made into a movie. I think they kind of had the soft soap a bit, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
We could do a much better job today, but I think it's a really, really great book. Review on the nature of innocence and people under great combat stress, you know. It may show what I actually did introduce it to a class where I had a bunch of African students, and they didn't openly come out and talk about their experiences, but it was pretty clear that three of them had been, you know, in serious military conditions since they were like 10 or 12, you know. And they were really, really receptive to this, that book. It was interesting.
Huh. Well, I did not know that there was to be an all-girl edition of Lord of the Flies as a movie.
Yeah,
but
it's on the dock, and a lot of people, you know, the first thought about it was that everyone dissed it and goes, you know, girls wouldn't do that. Girls are nice, you know. Girls don't beat each other up. You know, it's like, oh, right.
I think, you know, that they could potentially be worse than boys in that situation.
Well, fortunately, Jeremy, a bunch of mothers of daughters, you know, came in and on these threads on CNN, as you know how they go. And they go, are you kidding me? What are you talking about? I mean, it would be, there wouldn't, you know, Lord of the Flies. I mean, fuck. You know, they're going to, like, take people out and eat their hearts. What do you mean?
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, there was an adjustment for reality.
Well, I mean, let's see. How long were the kids there in the story of Lord of the Flies? How many weeks or months were they there?
Yeah, that's a good question. Not that long, really. Mm. Things deteriorated pretty quickly. I think that story is told over a couple of months, max. Yeah.
If it's a couple months, I mean, the girls could be open to, they would stand a better chance of becoming sick and getting infections, I would imagine, if they're in a tropical, like, wasteland or like a jungle, pretty much. I mean, they would stand to get sick quicker than the guys, wouldn't they?
Maybe not. But yeah, no, there could be that. There certainly could be skin issues, you know, and bacteriological things that happen that could be there, unless you're a little bit canny about the jungle.
Well, I mean, you know, their cycles, yeah. Their cycles would make them more susceptible to airborne sicknesses or mosquitoes, you know, things like that.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, that is true, and that's you know, from my experience in, you know, in jungles across the equator, you know, people say, well, it's terrible what, you know, quarantining women during menstruation and things like that. Well, actually, no, it's not. It's very smart. Smart for them, and it's smart for other people, too. You know, we all lose second-guess indigenous wisdom. We like it when we think they're nice natives doing cool things and being good for the environment. But when they do things that we think are not equal, then we have a problem with that. And, yeah, but still, they've been around for 40,000 years, and we haven't, you know. Now, I totally agree with that. This is one of my personal bugbears. You know, people talk about, this idealistic, romantic idea of what indigenous people are, and yet they have no idea whatsoever about the mindset or the conditions or the fact that there is really a very long history of, adapting to an environment. And maybe we just don't do that instantly. Maybe we do need 40,000 years somewhere to know what that is.
Since you brought it up, and I was keen to talk about it eventually anyway in more depth. Let's not talk about it the rest of the segment, but I would be interested to know what prompted you to go into the jungle and leave civilization behind, and didn't you allude to participating in rituals of something called shark magic with your son in this jungle?
Well, it's not just him. And he's from the island of Makira, which is in the Solomon Islands. Solomon Islanders have a very large and long-term tradition of what is called shark calling. And it's a method of rhythmic beating of the water, which summons moderate-sized sharks. And I guess you could call it a form of fishing, in a sense. They don't think of it as fishing, although they do sometimes eat the sharks. It's more communing with ancestors. They identify as sharks, as the people in the Sepik River of Papua New Guinea identify as crocodiles. I'm not sure who we identify with in America, probably as cars, or TVs, but it is a magical sort of ritual practice, but it's also very pragmatic as a way of fishing. And those people all learn to do that. To be an actual shark caller as a profession, if you like, is male driven. The mother of my son was the first daughter of one of those people. She's dead now. She inherited that title and prestige, but could not continue that practice on that civic level, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Wow. What made you want to go into the jungle, and how long did you live there?
Well, I guess now, when I think about it, I was starting to have real doubts about my own sense of culture. And one of my big points as a writer and as a thinker is that there's too much emphasis on our individual personalities. You want to be Jeremy, I want to be Chris, we want to dress a certain way, we want to be, protected, independent, dynamic individuals. And yet the reality is we really survive on the basis of an enormous amount of culture that we inherit. And I got a little glimpse into that and wanted to see more about my dependence on that. Kind of like breaking the dependence on the drug. That was my initial thinking. I wanted to see what my perspective really meant, south of the equator. Did it actually hold up? If it's a valuable thing, it should hold up. I mean, we are, you know, white people have been colonizing the whole world. I wanted to see, you know, to what extent I could take that with me. So that's what put me in that perspective. And when I got there, I found a great crisis of you know, a deep cultural crisis that was more than, it coincided with the personal affliction of malaria, which is not something to be toyed with, I can tell you. I mean, that's a disease you just don't want to get, and you have for life. But it was metaphorically connected with that, where I realized, oh my God, there are fucking boundaries in life. You know, there really are some lines you cross. It's not just the equator is not an abstract idea. You know, the 141st meridian is not an abstract idea. There are some things that are real, and you know, get with that program. And that was a tremendously adjusting period in my life, mid to late twenties. And for all the hassle of it, I wouldn't trade that for anything, you know. I would go back to that energy and that wave of realization that came out of that period. But it's hard to have that realization again, you know, on that level again, you know, as you get older. You know, you get one shot at like a real shakeup. In your whole thinking, and that's what you get. You know, you can't get another shakeup on that level. You know.
Well, that was brave, and I'm sure you've culled a lot of great stories from that time living in the wild. I mean, but here's an interesting question, because we're talking about books and the value of storytelling. What kind of stories did they tell in the tribe you lived, the people you lived amongst? Did they ever have time to tell stories? What did they say around the fires at night? I mean,
well, you know, here's an interesting thing. You know, when we look at like things like the body of European folk tales, you know, Grimm folk tales, you know, fairy stories and Little Red Riding Hood and stuff like that, you know, there's a very complicated psychological subtext. The stories, sometimes they're very, very bizarre, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, kids being, you know, cooked, you know, by old women, and, you know, all sorts of, and the same is true of the whole tradition of 1001 nights coming out of, you know, Persia, India, you know, in the Middle East. And what I found, and you only get if you go there, is that they have that same level of complexity in their stories. It's just that, you know, I could give you a book, which is a lovely illustrated book, and it, you know, it's the turtle and, you know, the shark, and it's a nice little fairy, you know, story kind of children's book of folk tales from Oceania, except that's not the stories they actually tell. They talk about giants or the demons and huge bird-like creatures, and, you know, it's really interesting, scary stuff, and you only get to hear that, you know, if you're listening to some sort of very obscure BBC documentary that was recorded by a Lutheran minister who happened to be on the case in 1964, or if you're actually there with them now. So they've been sanitized, you know, that it's nice to hear the turtle talk, you know, but what about the giant fucking bird creature? You know, we miss that, you know. So I did get that, and I'm very grateful for it, because it's weird. It's weird to hear another culture's version of other worlds, you know, and deep ancestor ghost worship, and there's a difference between those two concepts. So I was very grateful to be around the fire, and to, you know, I mean, I started to stay awake, you know, That was my thing, you know. It's like when the fire, you know, was on, it's like, oh, yep, time to stay really attentive.
You know? So, I mean, did they appreciate your storytelling skills, or were there better storytellers than you there, or what?
Well, they have a different style. But no, they did, actually. I think that's one of the reasons why I would even consider going back to those cultures. I'm not sure which of the islands I would focus on now, given, you know, just the realities of today. But, no, they were very receptive to that. They were receptive to the mix of song. My father, you know, I think I've told you he was a really fine singer. I'm not, but when I talk about him, when I tell stories about him, you know, I lapse into those songs. And they responded to that. They respond to basic techniques of suspense building. And I think humor is a very universal sort of concept. That what we, you know, as we started with, you know, talking about Exley's book, you know, the setup of an absolutely ridiculous situation. You know, someone is missing, you know, who can't hear or, you know, has a speech problem or whatever. You know, you build into that the story, and they were right with that. So it reinforced my idea that a lot of, I think not narrative so much, but drama and drama's comedic side, those are universal in a musical sense almost. You got to make some adjustments. You definitely do. My talk pitching was very good then. So I was able to communicate it that way. And I'm a natural sort of hand speaker. You know, I'm kind of a little bit Italian that way, even though I'm not. So that helps. You know, you got to use everything you got to get the story over. But it did reinforce to me the idea that of what a good story is something that does translate. I don't think it translates as obviously and quickly as a painting or a piece of music, that's clear, or a work of dance. But nevertheless, I think there is something more universal than we care to know, you know?
Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with the more experimental modes of fiction writing? Like, just a few offhand that I'll throw out there, such as pataphysics.
Oh yeah. That's Alfred Gerry, and Alipo and all that. Yeah.
Alipo. I was going to bring up Alipo, where you challenge yourself to write a text without using a certain letter of the alphabet. That sounds rough. I mean,
well, it's you know, I'm all into those techniques, and I was an early adopter of neuro-linguistic programming, which kind of has fallen out of favor since. But when it was first put forward, I thought it was very, very interesting. It's a psychotherapy technique that focuses on language. And for instance, you know, a therapist would listen to someone talking, patient, client talking, and try to highlight where they moved from nouns to verbs, focusing on the verb as being still something active and capable of change, the noun being a situation that was fixed, and trying to break them out of that. So, no, look, I support all those things. I think pataphysics, Alipo, you know, neurolinguistic, for anything at all that you can bring to the table.
What about
is what we
semiotics?
Need to bring to the table.
What about semiotics? You familiar with that?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Umberto Eco?
Well, he was, you know, I'm sorry he's gone. He was very, very smart, you know. I think some of it got a little bit too precious for work, but not in his case. I mean, I think he, you know, he was very, he was a great world intellectual, you know, in a way that we don't allow people in America to be that anymore. I think the fact that, you know, being an Italian, being a very certified academic, gave him a lot of platform in the world, and that was great. I would take alongside him one of my favorite writers of all time, Julio Cortazar. I don't know if you know him or know his work that much, but
I have heard that name, but what did he write? Did he write 31 and Model Kit?
62, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and he wrote a simply, do you know the term gobsmacking?
No, what is that?
Well, I don't know, gob is through your mouth. It's like, I can't fucking believe it, is what it means. He wrote his first book translated into English is called The Winners, Los Perez. It's about a group of people who win a lottery in Buenos Aires to take a cruise. And the moment they are outside of land, everything begins to shift on them. And it is simply one of the best. It's a big, early man, you know, young man's novel. It's big, 400 pages. And it's a little bit, you know, it could use some editing, and it's ambitious, but it is one of the best things I have ever read in my life. He anticipated the whole world of reality TV and so much of what's going on. It came out in the early 60s. It's just The Winners. It's published by Pantheon.
And that's called The Winners?
Yeah. It's a division of Random House, Pantheon. It was just the start of, I mean, I think he is, if people don't know, they can go online right now and read his story, The Axolotl, which is my big thing now of moving to animal perspectives, inhabiting animal consciousness in some way, you know. And he was on top of that then. He's considered part of the Spanish, you know, South American Revolution. He actually lived mainly in Spain and Europe and Paris. But he is mentioned often in the same sentences, Marquez and, you know, others. But I find him an experimental writer of just unknown depth. And if you ever track down his jobbing work as a journalist reviewing jazz in Paris, some of the best popular musical criticism you'll ever read in your life. It's phenomenal. It is simply phenomenal. You feel like you are there, and everything he says is just on the beat. So I have an enormous amount of time for him. Enormous.
Okay. Yeah, I've written down several titles here: A High Wind in Jamaica, The Turtle and the Shark, The Winners. Are you familiar with Robert F. Jones? He wrote Bloodsport, A Journey Up the Hassayampa.
No, I'm not. That sounds cool. No, I'm not.
Oh, my God. This book is incredible. Basically, this guy goes fishing on the Hassayampa River with his son. And the son gets abducted by this band of, like, marauders, because the Hassayampa River is actually almost like a portal to another world. It sits on the borderline of this other world. And the son gets abducted.
As rivers do.
Do what?
As rivers do.
Yeah. And this son gets abducted by this band of marauders. And I think the head of the band of marauders is named Rat Nose, and he's got all these, like, legends that are told about him passed down from generation to generation. Oh, he's Calvin Coolidge back from the dead, or he was born before his father was. All sorts of outrageous tall tales, and so his reputation precedes him. And what the father does when his son gets abducted by Ratnose is he disappears into the wilderness to chase after him and learns to live off the land, conditioning himself for the day when he will come face to face with Ratnose and get his son back. And it was written in the 60s or 70s, so there's no politically correct pretensions on display. It's just a book written for manly men who are literate. So I highly recommend that.
Wow, I've got to find that. Thank you very much. I'm going to add that smoke. We're a little bit challenged here now, aren't we, with these kind of stories?
Yes.
Thank God there's still some around. Thank you very much. I've written that down. I'm going to check that out. I mean,
definitely. So yeah, we've had a good we've rung about a good hour discussion out of this. Let's talk briefly about some good news with your own writing, The Humble Assessment. First, it became a play, which I understand went on to some critically good reception, and now it's to become a movie as well, right?
Yeah, it got produced in Australia, Israel, Ireland, and then it was a featured stage performance at the Vegas Fringe Festival. And the guy who contacted me about that, who made that happen, he's a really good director of stage stuff. That's his background. And his wife is the chief of vision, or was the chief of vision for Cirque du Soleil then, so they had a lot of technical skills, and they really did a nice job of bringing that play to fruition in Vegas as the featured, you know, thing for the Fringe Festival. And then he said, "Look, you know, what about a film version of this?" And I said, "Well, yeah, okay." So we embarked on that, and that's been an enormous undertaking. No budget. You know, if you have no budget, you're just at the mercy of everyone's work times, and people can be the most, courageous and dedicated, but it still takes time because you just don't have the money to pay them. So the film took a long time to develop, and it's half the running time of the play, which is a full-length evening's entertainment. But it's now gotten some major, coverage across about, we're working on 10 film festivals. We're not at the level of, Sundance yet. You have to kind of go through some hoops to get to that point. Basically, you need a producer to be behind you to pay the entry fee for those sorts of things. But we are making some real progress. And he and I have developed another TV series idea called The Chain, which I'm very proud of, which we're going to introduce to the Hollywood producers who have taken on board my idea, my book Private Midnight, which is my second novel and published by Overlook Press, and maybe my favorite work. It's certainly the most fulfilled work I've ever done. We think that's going to go ahead as a cable TV series. We're pitching to get a deal with, HBO or, Showtime, Netflix, second to. But we have this backup idea that I think is really interesting so we've got a lot to roll out in the new year. It's going to be very, very big. I'm trying to gear up myself, taking hot baths and, eating well, wanting to make some things really happen in my career in 2018. It's very hard times, as you know. I mean, I think we're at a point where we're wondering, all of us, can good work survive? Can it get audience?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to go out big time.
You know, as far as stories go, storytelling, and its many mediums from movies to television, which is kind of evolving into its own creature, there are actually some television series that have reached these artistic heights, you know, that are equally as relevant. And then, of course, we have literature that refuses to die. I mean, there are many mediums of storytelling, and so it's more competitive than ever, but I would think that this is all pointing towards good news for your future. Let's talk briefly about Lazy Fascist closing its doors, because you might disagree with this, but personally, I was very disappointed that Cameron, for the reasons Cameron Pierce gave in why Lazy Fascist was closing up shop, and that he was so embarrassed of the name itself, Lazy Fascist, because it had the word fascist in it, and because I guess he's terrified of the alt-right, I don't know, or he's afraid of political repercussions by those in his very own community if he clings too insistently to that name. He was even going to leave it off the last few releases of Lazy Fascist books. The whole tone of it, of his goodbye letter, his swan song, just read to me as so submissive, so placating. I was very disappointed for someone, one of the authors that I most looked up to in that little small press community. How did you feel about that announcement? And do you feel that there was any kind of throwing in the towel, any surrender there like I do?
Well, listen, I understand what you're saying, and I'm not going to say that I don't feel, you know, sad that particular enterprise is closing down. I was not as close to the other aspects of the Bizarro community in Portland, although I admire what they've done, and I'm grateful for the support they've offered me, and I will always, you know, generally be a supporter of them. My reading of it was that Kirsten and Cameron are embarked on having a family, and it's a new, you know, sort of situation for them. And I kind of took it as not a resignation, but just a movement forward in their lives. Mm-hmm. But I really understand what you're saying in terms of being sorry about you know, the closing of that small press. I'm not going to say otherwise. So I want to support them personally. They've been good to me, and I like them, and I think they're people of talent. And everyone changes and grows and goes into new phases in their lives. I do think that what you're saying has some thing that I do resonate with, and in the sense that I'm sad, you know. I wanted them particularly to keep publishing in Portland, and I'm afraid now that we've turned the corner on a certain kind of small indie press thing that may just, you know, knock out a whole world of possible communication. They published, you know, two of my books, and I hope those books still stay in print. But yeah, no, I hear you. I still like those people a great deal, and I don't feel they resigned in a personal sense, but I'm sad that enterprise won't be going forward the way it was, you know.
All right, I think we've reached the peak of what we can get out of this, and you've got to be going because you're soon to start your holiday celebration, as if I assume. But I wanted to throw you on the spot one more time, if that's okay.
Please.
Would you close us out with a Bob story? Bob being your pilot buddy who you spent a lot of years trading adventures and good times with.
Yeah, Oh, I love to talk about Bob. For starters, Bob disappeared on me, you know, back in the old days, faking his death, and he wasn't dead. And then he contacted me many years later, as people who work for the CIA kind of, you know, tend to do, right? But I'll tell you a story. He was a mentor in a way that everyone talks about wanting mentors and teachers and opportunities and, you know, if only someone would teach me something. Well, that's not always what you really want, is it? You know, you kind of want to teach the teacher, you know? And so, one time, he taught me a lesson that I'll never forget. I was the skydiver, right? That was my gig, you know? I worked for him, he was the pilot. And I would drop off antibiotics, guns, you know, food. I would negotiate meetings. I would do things across the islands, mainly the Bougainville Civil War conflict that we were involved in. But one time, over the Bismarck Sea, which is, it's a place of breathtaking beauty. You just can't imagine how beautiful the water looks. You think, this must be what heaven looks like. And I was getting ready to go out. I had everything ready. I had like 6 drop bags. Like, they would come out on a chain, you know, after me, under parachute. And, but there was, you know, it was like bringing like big suitcases out the plane with you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was all ready to go. And code is checking in, checking out. And then you sit another time. And then on the out, you're gone. And the pilot knows you're gone. And Bob did something to me then that I still wonder about now. But he hit me with a tranquilizer dart. This is the second time he'd done that. One time, we had a crocodile that we were repossessing and moving to a more humane setting. But I was just, I didn't have a flak jacket on. You know, I just took the shot straight in the chest. And I wobbled and fell over, and I looked at him and thought, what's happening? And he pulled out a parachute and went out of the plane. And I am not a pilot. I'm not qualified to be a pilot in any jurisdiction in the world. I can fly a helicopter under really difficult circumstances.
Like being hit with a tranquilizer dart?
No, I do not.
Really difficult conditions like being hit with a tranquilizer dart, right?
You know, and I was just thinking to myself, what's going to happen now? You know? And I woke up, and the plane is coasting, you know? We're losing altitude. I've got no idea where Bob is. And I get to the cockpit, and there's a little note. Welcome to the world. You know? And I just thought, you fucker. That is not a way to teach people. That is not an approved academic teaching strategy. You know? It's just not. But, you know, it was a pontoon plane, I gotta say. Thank goodness. And I did have an idea about that. If you land on water, you've got much better chance than if you land on ground. That's not easy. Landing on ground is not easy. Anyone who says it is in a fixed-wing airplane is an idiot, you know? But that was the moment, you know? That was the moment. He was willing to do anything to break me through to another level. And I've never met anyone like that ever again, you know? He had faith in me. I wasn't going to sort of burn his plane up, you know? And I wasn't going to kill myself. He somehow knew that, you know? And I never have had anyone believe in me like that.
That's incredible. I keep waiting for you to publish like a book of Bob stories, the Book of Bob or something.
It's coming.
Excellent.
It's coming, Jeremy. It is. Yeah, it's coming. It's been a long time. You know, someone that big in your life, you need some time to move them around in your head, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It just was too big a thing for me to... I wanted to write about it in the moment. I really did. And a lot of my book is from that period, you know?
Which one? Enigmatic Pilot?
No, Archipelagon is what it's called.
Oh.
It's a new book that I'm... it's about... I try, actually, to suppress, in a sense, the Bob element. Because he's such a powerful figure.
Mm.
And I focus on four other people who, in that island world, two of them come unglued forever, and two of them find themselves. And that's the story I think I can tell. You know, you have to write about the story you can tell. The European white people in a really radical environment. That's the story I can tell. I still don't understand those crazy locals, the nationals, you know?
Mm.
I mean, I mingled with them. I really did. I think I mingled with them pretty definitely. But I'm not claiming I understand them. But I do know those crazy white people, you know? And that's what the story's about, you know? People who come unglued at the... south of the equator. Or maybe find themselves, you know?
Yeah. It's incredible. You've lived an incredible life. And that's why I always defer to you when you say something controversial, because I know that you have been in a situation that is far more insightful than anything your detractors have to offer on the subject. So... I thank you for coming on, and maybe we could make this a more regular thing every so often, where you just come on to talk about books or even just life, and, you know, just facing danger. I don't know, something like that.
I'd appreciate that. I enjoy talking to you, and I really admire your value of books and complicated thoughts and things that aren't easy, you know. Today, everyone wants everything easy and prepackaged and, you know, ideas that are really not very hard to, you know, dismantle. And I appreciate that you're interested in more complicated things, and I thank you for your support. So I'm always happy to be part of anything, anytime.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Chris, and farewell wherever you may fare, all right?
Cool, man. I'll be in touch. I'm off to where James Cook got murdered in Hawaii.
Wow. Well, I'm sure that'll be a ride.
You're all fucking autistic.